Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 256, which is an amazing number, by the way, because the next time I'm going to celebrate this number is when we get to 512, which is another binary number. I know. So that means I have to do another 256 to get to this one. This episode is Vicky Dobbs-Beck, who's an executive in charge at ILM XLab, and I met her at THU in Malta earlier this year. She is a fascinating woman.
Yeah, she's very smart.
Very, very smart. Mm-hmm. Very, very smart, and has a long history in both business and the visual effects world. What were some of your thoughts about her?
Well, I thought it was cool kind of when she first heard about ILM, she found out she knew someone at Stanford, so mm-hmm. she kind of pursued the routes that she knew there.
But she went to Stanford Business School, right?
Business School, yes. Right. Found out. Got kind of an interview, didn't, but she kind of always had that dream in her mind.
Uh-huh.
And the quote I took from the podcast was, she said, keep the dream alive over time, but have things along the way while pursuing your passion, which right. I thought was very cool because she kind of was going to graduate without getting the job. And then they called her at the last minute
yes.
and she went. Ended up writing the business plan.
Yeah, she wrote the first business plan for ILM back in 1988.
Yeah.
So think about that.
That was very cool. And,
yep.
and she kind of says that she's not very creative, but she really is.
She is.
And businessy at the same time. It's a cool and kind of how her job's evolved since she started. I don't know. It was a really good podcast.
I
loved it.
She's fascinating. Mm-hmm. And obviously with ILM XLab, she's sort of always kept on the cutting edge of things. XLab's doing a bunch of amazing work in immersive reality, they're calling it, mm-hmm. or something of that nature.
Yeah.
So there's obviously a lot of stuff that's going on there. So really great to have Vicky on. And she was a super, super kind person. I hung out with her at Malta quite a bit. So THU is always a wealth of people that bring the people to that conference. So it's really cool. Speaking of great conferences, what is going on? We are amongst the pressure to build Total Chaos. So what's going on there?
All right. So, well, you can find this out at chaosgroup.com/events, and it is Total Chaos 2020.
Mm-hmm.
It will be happening in Sofia, Bulgaria, our home,
mm-hmm.
May 29th through 31st.
Mm-hmm.
And you can experience an extraordinary collection of artists and designers from the world's leading visionaries. There'll be art, architecture, advertising, automotive design, interior design, games, and visual effects. And if you want to visit the website, it's chaosgroup.com/total-chaos.
Yeah. And it's absolutely, it's really great. And we have a huge lineup of people. Now, you know, if you go to chaosgroup.com/total-chaos, you will see some of those speakers, but there's a lot more to be announced. And it's going to be really, really amazing this year.
Mm-hmm.
Every year we say, I don't know if we're going to top last year. And every year we outdo what we did last year.
It's going to be pretty fun
yeah,
this year.
It's really great. I'm really excited about it. All right. And if people want to know more about the podcast, where can they find that out?
You can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast.
Right. Or they can also go to our website itself, which is chaosgroup.com/CG Garage. If you'd like to, if you have suggestions or ideas or comments or questions, you just go to labs@chaosgroup.com. That's again, labs@chaosgroup.com. And we always appreciate any feedback you guys have on Apple Podcasts. That's a big deal for us. So if you go to Apple Podcasts or you go there, make sure and subscribe, like, share, and leave us a comment, good or bad. We'd love to have it. All right. With that being said, please enjoy this incredible podcast with Vicky Dobbs-Beck at ILM XLab.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
We are in great shape. Thank you so much for being here. So what I love to start with is some origin stories.
Okay. Well, my origin story is quite long.
Well, let's do it. We've got an hour.
Okay.
So where does it start?
Well, actually, I'm going to talk about it in in my talk on Wednesday, but I think my origin story for Lucasfilm
right.
begins when I was at Stanford Business School.
Okay.
And I basically made a choice, a different one than about 95% of my classmates who always, you know, went into investment banking and consulting and so forth.
Yep.
And I decided I wanted to work for a company whose product was inherently creative.
Okay. That's
my only criteria. It could have been fashion, performing arts, wine, entertainment.
Right.
And I happened to be reading the Stanford Daily, and I saw this story about a guy named Walt Conti.
Okay.
Who worked on Star Trek Episode 4 and worked on the animatronic whales.
Oh, yeah.
So I saw that, and I was like, wow, that's fascinating. And,
uh-huh.
and then it talked about the fact that Industrial Light and Magic was in Northern California,
uh-huh.
and I thought, it's like an interesting place to work.
Right. And you're at Stanford. So.
And I was at Stanford. And it turns out Walt Conti was 1 year ahead of me, Stanford undergrad. So I thought, we must know people in common.
Sure.
And so I started, you know, asking around. And sure enough, you know, one thing led to another. And I finally met someone who worked for Industrial Light and Magic.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually volunteered to work at ILM between my 2 years of business school.
Okay.
I volunteered to work for free. And I suggested like 3 projects that I thought I could help with, and they turned me down. And you know, I was like, "How do you turn down free help?"
Right.
And then I, you know, in retrospect, I really think they just didn't know what to do with me, and I think they were a little afraid that I might be, you know, more work than I could deliver
sure.
value. So I ended up actually working for the San Francisco Ballet between my 2 years at Stanford.
Okay.
And I was just about to graduate my second year without a job because it was hard to find jobs in the creative industry. You know, those kinds of recruiters did not come on campus
right.
and so forth. And about a week before I was going to graduate, I got this call from
okay.
ILM. And I had been checking in with them over the course of the year. And they said, we have an opening.
Mm-hmm.
And we are wondering if you're interested in coming in and interviewing us. Of course, yes, you need to come in this time on this date. And I was like, oh, I would really love to do that, but I have a final project, a group project
right.
that's actually at that time that we have to present. And they're kind of like, well, you know,
right.
it's then or not, you know, not at all.
Right.
So I talked to my group. They were amazing. They just said, you got to do it. You got to try.
Okay.
And so I went up there and interviewed for a very entry-level position. It was like a marketing assistant role. And I ended up getting the offer.
Uh-huh.
I joke sometimes that I probably had the lowest paying, most interesting job in my graduating class. and so I went in and my boss at the time said, do you know anything about writing or creating a marketing report?
Uh-huh.
And I said, or a marketing plan. And I said, well, I know something about a marketing plan. I just don't know almost anything about the industry.
Right.
And I said, do you have a business plan? And she looked at me with this sort of blank stare.
Right.
And I said, well, you know something that talks about the growth plans and the industry and so forth. And she said, not really. And I said, well, I'll tell you what. You tell me who to interview. I will talk to them, and even if I'm 100%, I'll write something up, and then even if I'm 100% wrong,
right.
it'll give people something to respond to.
Sure, sure.
So that's what I did, and I ended up writing the first sort of ILM business plan.
Wow. What year was this?
It was like in 1988.
Okay.
This is a while ago.
Yeah.
It's gotten much more sophisticated since then.
Right.
But what was great about it is they started moving me around Lucasfilm,
uh-huh.
kind of trying to come up with a, you know, business strategy for all these new little activities. And at the end of that, I...
So that link who's like Skywalker Sound and
it
all
would,
that stuff.
It would have been not Skywalker Sound per se, but there was like a location-based entertainment group that
Got
was
it.
Starting out.
Yep, yep.
And another was this little group that was inside of LucasArts, which was the games division. It
okay.
was called Lucasfilm Learning.
Okay.
And you know, I didn't have an educational background, I didn't have a technology background, but in any case, Lucasfilm Learning was a real turning point for me because the goal of that group was really to innovate in education and to bring together storytelling, high-quality media, and interactivity. And the way you did it back then was with a computer-driven laser disc player. This is pre-CD-ROM.
Right, the big ones.
The really big ones. It delivered really beautiful imagery,
yeah.
But it was a really complicated setup.
You know,
probably too complicated for schools.
Mm-hmm.
But we were doing some really interesting prototyping work and I would say groundbreaking in the area. And it really became my passion for all the years that followed.
Okay.
And I left for 4 years. I was interested in, you know, cross-platform children's edutainment, and that wasn't really a place that Lucasfilm wanted to go at that time. Ironically, I worked for Disney,
right.
which ended up coming full circle later.
Sure.
And then I went back to ILM 4 years later, in a more operational role, and then I moved into strategic planning, and I did that for many, many, many years.
Okay.
But I was constantly watching this convergence of interactivity, high-quality media, and the technology landscape.
Right.
And finally, about 2013-14, it really started to come together. That opportunity.
Okay.
Began to be realized. And I was quite inspired by another person who's at the conference, Kim Librari.
Yeah, I know Kim.
So Kim was really, he's very forward-looking.
Mm-hmm.
He was very much of the mind that I was. And the work that he was doing in sort of real-time computer graphics and R&D in that space was, I think, really groundbreaking in terms of how it applied to entertainment. So that inspired me, and I stayed alongside it because it was a strategic initiative. It sort of made sense.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, we founded ILMX Lab in 2015, and a bit after that, I took over as executive in charge,
right.
And I've been doing that ever since.
Wow, okay.
Told you, long story.
Actually, not that long. There's a lot of details I want to go through. I want to know what was something that motivated you that you wanted to do something in a creative field?
You know what, that goes back to like my childhood.
Let's find out.
Okay.
Because there's several things. Okay, here's what I'm going to get at. I want to know why that happened, and I want to know what you can take to help people in the creative field understand why your job makes sense for people who want to do creative things. Because, you know, ILM didn't have a business plan. They didn't have these things, and you brought that to them that allowed them to grow. And people need to know that. So what's your creative drive?
I think I actually had sort of two drives when I was really young.
Yeah.
I was sort of an entrepreneur at heart
when
I was young.
Yeah.
When I was like 12, I started a small business with my mom.
Uh-huh.
We made dried flower arrangements, which we sold at the public market in Seattle.
Nice.
And so that entrepreneurial spirit was always with me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would do things like I love to write.
Okay.
Like fiction.
Right.
And so I'd write kids' stories, and then I would hire illustrators to illustrate them because I wasn't an artist myself.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where that all began. And it just, I had a really interesting experience at business school.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably some of the best advice I ever got. So it was in my heart always.
Right.
But, and in fact, the fact that I went to business school is a little unusual in and of itself, except it did feed the entrepreneurial side. But I would have loved to have gone into creative writing, for example. But I thought that by going to business school, it was probably a safer path and one that would be more likely to yield a career.
Sure.
But then I got through my 2 years and I was kind of back where I was at the beginning, which is to say, how do I get into this creative field? So during the 2 years before I worked for the San Francisco Ballet and volunteered to work for free at ILM, they did have on-campus recruiting, and I was interviewing for a management consultant role.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually interviewing for a company where I knew the person that was interviewing. And he said, you know, Vicki, you have such a creative spirit. I just I'm not sure I see you in this role. I would really encourage you to do something creative for the summer. And if you're in a creative industry for the summer, and if you don't, if you feel as you get ready to graduate that you're convinced, you know, management consulting is the path, then let's talk about it and look into a full-time role. And honestly, I did what he suggested and I never looked back.
Right. That's great advice.
Yeah.
That's like one of the best rejections you can get.
It was ironic, yeah. And you know, I really believe, and I say this to everyone, you have to follow your heart. You have to follow your passion. Because otherwise, I think that, you know, you'll never feel that sense of fulfillment. And I do feel fulfilled right now. You know, there's a lot of classmates that I had at business school who have done extraordinary things, and they've made a lot of money, and they have foundations, and, you know, all of those things. That is not the path that I chose.
Right.
But I do feel really, I feel really blessed that I did choose the path that I did, because I think that, you know, I love being on sort of the bleeding edge of creativity, and in this space, it's, you know, immersive storytelling, and every day is an adventure. You know, it's truly, there's so much that we're constantly learning, discovering, paving new ground.
Sure. Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a very interesting thing. And I think, you know, XLab is actually a fascinating thing that you guys have done and that you guys have been involved with. I'm really curious about your take on it and about what you feel. Why did it happen? What was the motivation to make that happen? Obviously, there's a lot of R&D groups here and there, but XLab is a little bit different.
It is different, and I think that, well, the first time I put on a VR headset, which was a DK2, I think, people described what it was, but I truly had no idea. You know, you can't prepare yourself to what it's like to put something on and be inside of a world. Because for so long, we had been separated by a screen, whether you're playing a game or a movie or television. And it was, you know, it was a really, really simple and crude example of VR at the time. But it was mind-blowing to me. And and I felt like this is truly a new medium for storytelling.
Right.
And it allows you to connect to place, you know, to worlds and to characters in ways that just simply weren't possible with any other medium.
Sure.
So, you know, because Lucasfilm at its core is about storytelling, it made sense that when there was a new way to tell stories that we should be there and that we should be pioneering. And it's been, like I said, it's been a journey. There's no way to describe it other than a journey.
Right. No.
That is not over.
Right. Now, has the focus always been primarily VR?
No. Actually, we very intentionally, when we founded ILMX Lab, we said we were the immersive entertainment studio.
Immersive entertainment.
Yeah, because we didn't want to limit ourselves. A lot of people at the time were setting up divisions, and they called them, you know, XYZ VR.
Right.
And we intentionally did not do that. Even though VR was a real opportunity at that point, we were equally interested in, you know, augmented or mixed reality, which has been a little slower to come online in the way that we probably would engage, which would be more with wearables and so forth. As well as even just, you know, we did a demonstration at Sundance a few years ago called Hollow Cinema, and we were using stereo glasses and projections, and it allowed you to step inside a world also, and that didn't involve VR or AR, although it actually simulated what VR or AR could be like, right?
Okay. Yep.
So really, the defining element was more this idea of a full immersion.
Okay. Okay, absolutely. Okay, so you were a storyteller. You wrote children's books. You had them illustrated, which is great and wonderful. But let's talk about story in VR. Because this has been the subject that I've talked about on the podcast now, and there's a huge challenges to writing story for VR. So what are some of the challenges that you have found, and how have you overcome some of those things?
Well, I can talk about it in the context of a couple of different examples.
That'd be great.
I would say that, so we're interested in immersive experiences that are for locations mm-hmm. and or for the home, and they do have different opportunities and
sure.
challenges.
Because you guys did stuff with
The Void.
The Void, yes.
Exactly. So one of the things about, the first major project we did was Carne y Harina
okay.
with Alejandro Iñárritu.
Uh-huh.
It was a, VR first. Experience, meaning Alejandro never envisioned it in any other form, like a short film, etc. He was intrigued by the medium and what it could do.
Sure.
And that experience actually put you into a scene. Mm-hmm. And the scene was of a group of immigrants crossing the border from Mexico into the United States
yes.
in the middle of the night and getting caught. And in that particular case, you're actually an observer, and you're in the middle of the scene. It feels like it's happening around you. It is incredibly intense, and so it was a more linear unfolding of a scene, but there was so much happening in that scene. In contrast to a film, where he would choose camera angles, etc. In this case, you were the one deciding where you were going to look.
Sure.
And so, even though the scene never changed.
Yep.
Your experience in the scene changed based on, where you were looking and how you were engaging. And one of the challenges was people wanted you to look in a particular place at a particular time in a perfect world, but you can't control it. I mean, the person themselves becomes the camera.
Right.
And so you can do a lot of things. You can use sound, effective use of sound, effective use of light, possibly dialogue, etc., but you can't control it. And I think the power of it comes when you design something that allows you to be in the world, but is not necessarily dependent on you having to experience it in a particular way.
Okay.
And so that was our first step. And then I would say, actually, probably one of the best examples is Vader Immortal, episode one.
Yeah.
Because that we really wanted to create an interactive narrative. And interestingly, we started from a similar place to where we were with Carne y Harina. We mm-hmm. we thought we're going to let you be an observer. We're going to have the story unfold around you. Mm-hmm. But we've always been dealing in real-time experiences, so it's which means that they can be interactive, mm-hmm. right? And we thought that's, it would probably be a lot more powerful to put you at the center of the experience, which was a very interesting choice because we were dealing with Darth Vader.
Right.
And this is probably the most iconic character in the Star Wars uh-huh. universe, and yet the story is your story.
Right.
So it's your story and your relationship with Vader and how that unfolds. So that was interesting in and of itself, just to put you at the center.
Right.
The other thing is that we did use gaze-based mechanics. So in certain cases, we didn't allow something to happen or Vader to deliver dialogue until you were looking at him.
Okay.
So we did, so the length of the experience does fluctuate based on
what you're doing,
what you do and how you do it and
okay.
when you do it. So that was very important. The other choice that we made is it's not a branching story. It's the story is the same story,
okay.
But you have to interact with the world and with the characters in order to push the story forward.
Okay.
So again, this was a balance between the narrative and the interactivity and agency. And so that's been an interesting learning. The other thing about the actual creation process, and this was true really in the Void experiences too, is because we come from a film background, of course, we started in a classic film-based mm-hmm. Way and said, first thing to do is to write a script. And one of the things we very quickly realized in both the location-based experiences with the Void and with Vader Immortal is that in order for it to be effective, it had to be a highly iterative process,
okay,
where you're constantly moving from the person or people who are driving story and the people who are driving the actual interaction and experience design. So we had David S. Goyer was the executive producer and writer on Vader Immortal.
Okay.
And you know, he'd done Blade, he'd done some games work, etc. So he actually had experiences in both mediums, and we kind of developed new tools for helping the broader team understand what the vision for the experience was,
right,
more than just a straight up script.
Okay.
And so there are tools that led to creating this story that were sort of behind the scenes, but I think were really important to making it what it ultimately is. So we, you know, the other thing that we decided to do very consciously was have it be an episodic. So it's
three episodes.
And the episodes are about, you know, anywhere, I mean, it depends, but episode one was between 45 minutes and an hour of the interactive narrative. So it was longer than a lot of, and it was about as high fidelity as you could make
okay.
on these headsets.
Right.
But one of the interesting things about it is the reason Oculus came in and really funded this and supported this is because they were releasing the Quest, you know, which is a
yes.
tetherless headset.
Yes.
And everybody realized once you put the Quest on that it was a game changer,
mm-hmm.
especially with something like a lightsaber.
Right.
Right? Because the ability to move around in 360 degrees.
And dodge things. Yeah.
Without getting twisted in cords, making it accessible to people that don't really have the high-powered computer setup, etc. It was amazing. So it was so much fun to do lightsabers that we did have this momentary dilemma
uh-huh.
about literally we were afraid people were going to, there's a point where you go into a training dojo
uh-huh.
in the actual experience because you have to use the lightsaber as a tool and as a weapon in
the experience. Okay.
But we were afraid people were just going to stay in the training dojo, right? They were just going to be having so much fun that they weren't going to actually push through.
Sure.
So we consciously decided, and this is, you know, this is not from the beginning. This was
you go through it.
Well, this was, I mean, in the creation process,
yeah.
this was somewhere toward the middle of the process. We said, what if we created two modules?
Okay.
There's actually an interactive narrative module. That's the one that's like 45 minutes to an hour. And there's then a separate lightsaber dojo experience. And this was something that, I mean, it was kind of a serendipitous, you know, stroke of genius, if you will, because I think we stumbled into it. It wasn't like we had this vision from the beginning. So we have two modules.
Right.
One, the interactive narrative, one, the lightsaber dojo. In the lightsaber dojo, you can basically wield a lightsaber to your heart's content. There's like 40 or 50 rounds, and it gets extremely hard. I mean, I can get to like round 5.
Okay.
But for some people who are much more committed
sure.
and perhaps more game-oriented, they
right.
can go on for hours and hours. So that structure was so successful that we decided to pursue that structure going forward.
Okay. So sounds like you're compared to those two different experiences. One is more passive, so third person narrative, and the second one is first person narrative.
Very much so.
Right. So the first person narrative, like I always look at VR and I think sometimes I feel, it depends on the content, but sometimes I feel awkward when I'm a third-person narrative in a VR content because I'm just observing, right?
Yeah.
But if you're talking about something traumatic that's happening and you're in the middle of it, that could be very...
It still feels like you're there and you feel the sense of chaos, the sense of fear,
mm-hmm.
the sense of tension. And I'm not going to ruin the experience, but there is a moment where you wonder if you've actually been an observer at all.
Right.
And that was a very conscious choice as well. I think, you know, for us, for VR in particular, it's true great strengths. Two true great strengths are the power of presence,
yep,
and the power of connection. And I think that we are constantly looking for ways to lean into that. And one of the things that, I don't know if this is going to be true forever,
sure,
but I think it's true right now because VR is still so new, mm-hmm, is that there's a really visceral response to it, something you don't get from a film or television, etc. And when I, for example, talk about Carne Irina, or even Vader Immortal, when Vader, this door opens and Vader walks toward you and looks you straight in the eyes, and, you know, I mean, he's very overwhelming. Mm-hmm. I can actually feel it in my body, like even as we're talking,
right?
Because it has such a powerful impact from when you do it that it stays with you. It creates a memory in a different way than other forms of media.
Interesting. Okay. All right. I can see that. But the other thing that I thought I think is interesting is that you basically brought in a game. Right, you brought in the idea of a game to help the story narrative. So although it sounds like when you split those two different,
yeah,
stories, the dojo and the game, the dojo as, you know, do what you want to do and,
yeah,
play the game, right?
Yeah.
And the other one is like, okay, you're about to have an experience and it's 45 minutes to,
yeah,
an hour. But it still relies on input from you, right?
Yeah.
It still relies on that.
It totally does. And I would say the way we usually describe it is we definitely use game mechanics.
Okay.
To drive the narrative forward.
Right.
But we still believe it's not a game. At the end of the day, on the narrative piece,
mm-hmm,
the most important thing was that you experienced it as a narrative where you were the center of that experience.
It's true. So, you know, it's interesting that you say that because, I mean, I've been trying to figure this out for years, and like what, on the creative side, like what does it really mean? There's a game I played, which I absolutely adore, and I still talk about it, called BioShock Infinite, right? I don't know if you've ever heard of it.
I've heard of it, but
okay,
yeah.
But the story is so good, that I wish there was a mode in the game where I don't actually have to play the game.
Yeah.
I could just move forward and experience, because it's a linear story, it doesn't change. It's just like,
yep,
what you just described.
Yep.
So I really wish there was a moment where I could just experience the whole game as a narrative.
Yeah.
And that would be really great. And still feel, it still feels very compelling. So
yeah.
I think there's definitely room for that as a medium. What is your thoughts about that medium? Because I know you guys won an Oscar for some of that.
That was, Carne Irina won a special Oscar,
okay,
actually, for really visionary storytelling in a new medium.
Right.
And prior to that, the last time they had given a special Oscar was to Toy Story, to John Lasseter in Toy Story. So,
okay.
I think that Oscar was indicative of how groundbreaking Alejandro's vision was.
Right.
And I think this idea that you're describing, which is essentially a story mode, for lack of a better term.
It is, but it's more than that. But it's for lack of a better,
yeah,
term.
Because I mean, one thing about Vader Immortal is you don't die, you don't get stuck.
Right.
I mean, you will literally eventually push through.
Right.
So you will experience the narrative. It is true that you have to do something. And, you know, we've been talking about more of a, like, what happens if you just, I mean, the way we designed it, it would be hard for that particular experience to experience it purely as a narrative because the triggers are in your hands, if you will.
Sure.
But certainly Carne Irina was that way. It was a full-on story. And I'm constantly intrigued by how people are sort of grappling with what is the right balance between,
uh-huh,
between story and interactivity. And one of the very first experiments we did was actually on an iPad. And, well, it's maybe not immersive as some people would normally think of it. What it was a like a 90-second scene.
Okay.
And you viewed it on an iPad, and most people would think that it was actually a scene from a film. It looked great. It was a high-fidelity scene from Star Wars. What you didn't realize is that it was running in real time. So, you know, sort of the reveal was after you watched it, now you can go into that world. The whole world existed, and these multiple intersecting storylines were all happening in real time,
right?
So now you could go through into that world and experience it in a different way.
Sure.
So there's a scene where C-3PO and R2-D2 come out of this hut, and the way the cutscene worked is you saw them emerging from the hut. Mm-hmm. But when you go into the real time mode, you can actually go into the hut just before they walked out, so in time, and see what was happening what was actually going on. Because in the cutscene, and this is true, obviously, of television and film, is a director made a choice about what you were going to see and what you didn't see as a result, because it happened simultaneously.
Yep.
In this case, you were in this dynamic world, literally, and you could choose where to be when. And we did some other things. We experimented with, like, point of view. You could change you could be in one of the characters' point of view. You could potentially change the environment. You know, we did some light things, like you could have a sandstorm, you know.
Sure.
And if you chose to make a sandstorm and then you played the cutscene again, it would have the sandstorm in it.
Right.
So we were just sort of doing some really early experimentation on what would it be like to have a very cinematic, very narrative driven, in many cases, iPad experience with running in real time. What could you do that was unique? And I still think there's a lot of power in that experience. The challenge with it was when we did it, it required one very powerful computer in the cloud to render it, right? So it wasn't a cost-effective experience at the time. But, you know, already cloud computing and so forth has become, you know, it's come down so much in price that we're probably getting close to a time when you could actually do something like that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think it's fascinating. I think there's a lot, because I think a lot of people sometimes, they just, especially in the early days, what you guys have done sounds exactly like where it needs to be going, because in the early days people just looked at VR as an evolution of 3D, which is not.
Yes.
What it's supposed to be, right?
Yeah.
So, and you guys have been, you know, because I always use the expression, when filmmakers take it on, it's like when the only tool you know how to use is a hammer, then all your problems look like nails, right?
Right.
So
right.
They're always going to just like, well, I'm just going to edit it this way. It's like, well, no. And it's and I think it's interesting that while what you guys have done employs a lot of techniques that the gaming industry has done, you're not necessarily making a game. But you're employing those techniques because why not? They work.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So it's a really interesting idea of what that is. Now, how did you guys come up with the business model for this? Like, how is this going to work? Like, what are people going to, you know, you said you experienced it through going to a venue, special venue, right? Or you experience it at home.
Different experiences for each of those. So Star Wars Secrets of the Empire, which is the Void experience, was designed to optimize what you can do in a location-based setting. So you control all the environment, you can invoke all the senses, because you have that ability.
Right.
You were experiencing it with others. It was a situation where you were with four. So in that case, we were really trying to make sure that the experience was fun with people.
Yep.
And that we could use, again, this sort of sensory experience. Like there were transducers in the floor, rumbled. Mm-hmm. You were on Mustafar.
Mm-hmm.
It smelled like lava.
Yep.
It was, we were, we were, it was hot, you mm-hmm. know, the heat went up and so forth. So two things about that. One is again, we were designing to take advantage of the fact that it was a location that we controlled 100%. Mm-hmm. That business model was pretty straightforward, right?
Okay.
Because you sell tickets,
yep.
And it was a business model people understood.
Sure.
But also from a creative perspective, we very consciously set that void experience before in time, just before Vader Immortal. So in The Secrets of the Empire, you're on Mustafar on an outpost. You see Vader's castle in the distance. In Vader Immortal, you actually go into Vader's castle and you confront him face to face and you engage yeah. with him.
Right.
So, but in, you know, in time, in chronology, Secrets of the Empire led to Vader Immortal, and there is a light connective tissue between the two that
That's
shall
cool.
be reviewed.
Sure, yeah, okay.
So that was important from a creative perspective, and
right.
And then, you know, like I said, really designing for, I mean, what location base is great for is scope and scale.
Okay.
And the ability to invoke all the senses and to have a shared experience. What home is, you know, what is really significant, I think, about home experiences, it gives you the opportunity for extended engagement.
Okay.
Which gave us an opportunity to develop a more robust, longer story experience.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I think that's interesting to do that. So I'm going to change subject a little
yeah.
bit. I might come back to it. So there's a lot of people out in the world, especially if you come to an event like THU, that are very, very creative people, and they have an idea that they want to do something independent, right?
Yep.
They want to go out and it's like, I want to make my own movie, or I want to start my own studio, or, you know, I've got the best creative friends in the world. We should all come together and
yep.
make a business. That's a challenge. What do you think you could give them as advice if they want to do that, especially since I'm going to assume in this hypothetical that none of them have any business experience?
Yeah, well, I'm just going back to, I forgot to say that, you know, you asked about business model.
Right.
And on Vader Immortal, it's actually being sold through the Oculus store
okay.
On a per episode basis.
Okay.
Right? So it's actually being sold.
Right.
It is challenging right now to do really high quality experiences and expect to make the money back.
Right.
And so you kind of have to find partners that have other goals that make sense to engage. So in Oculus's case, they were obviously interested in driving Quest sales, and
right.
and it was great to have a really big IP like Star Wars to help do that.
Right.
At OC. Five, so just really literally about a year ago,
mm-hmm.
I remember Mark Zuckerberg saying something to the effect of there needed to be 10 million devices of one kind in the hands of consumers before it was probably going to really be viable to invest a lot of money in development and expect
mm-hmm.
to get it back. That's a lot.
That is a lot.
So that... I think people have to take a long-term view of this. And if I were, you know, sort of in the situation that you were describing, I'd probably do two things. One is to create prototypes to try to express the vision that I have for these immersive experiences. That'll certainly help in terms of getting people excited about the possibilities. But it might take time to get, you know, the money to produce that at a higher quality, you know, or the quality you envision. I do think it is looking for, I mean, even we do this all the time, we're looking for stepping stones. You know, this might be our vision out here in the future, but there are ways to sort of step our way toward that future when that future materializes.
Okay.
And that might be anything from working in a more traditional media
okay.
where it's a little bit, where there's more common sources of support. I guess the other thing I would say is that a number of these devices in the new media space, literally,
mm-hmm.
Epic, HTC, Magic Leap.
Yep.
I don't even know all of them. Microsoft. I believe that most, if not all of them, have grant programs. And what they're trying to do is, support the industry, give the industry momentum.
Well, they need content.
They need content. Because it will die without great content. So I would also suggest, really looking into these grant programs and applying to them. There are more now than there were, say, 2 years ago.
Okay. So, but you're going to get that grant money if you have really good creative.
That I believe so.
Right.
I mean, I'm not a part of those decision making.
You have to make creative choices. So you start with a prototype and then you go.
I'm not familiar enough with the programs to know exactly what's required. It mm-hmm. may be that just a vision,
right.
like storyboards, some art, concept art and words, mm-hmm. maybe that's enough. I'm not actually sure.
Okay.
I always think that, and especially in the case of these, these kinds of companies, they understand how the words and the art translates into experiences because that's what they do every day.
Sure.
In contrast to when you're trying to help someone understand the power of VR who's never put a VR headset on before.
Okay.
Then I think the only way to do it is to, is to get somebody in the headset.
Right.
Along those lines, even internally when we were trying to get people excited about us doing Vader Immortal, We did a test, an internal test, and the test was, you're in this prison cell. The doors open. You hear Vader's breathing. Mm-hmm. He walks toward you. He looks you in the eye, and he delivers some dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is that it was so impactful. Our question was, is this as impactful as we think it will be?
Sure.
No one knew for sure.
Right.
Well, it turns out it was so impactful that most people actually didn't hear the dialogue.
They were
literally overwhelmed by being in that world, being with Vader. And that actually goes back to one of the other things you were asking about, in terms of storytelling and
right.
in VR in particular, is pacing is really different.
Oh, okay.
Because we had to slow the pacing way down because people missed the cue. And we had to create this test to get people behind the idea that this was this was an important project to pursue.
Interesting.
For the franchise.
Yeah. Okay. That's great advice for people, because I think there's a lot of things that people are doing. Obviously, real time is another thing that's become.
Well, I think at THU, they have a whole track on mm-hmm. Unreal.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things we're doing at ILM is trying to help people learn to work on, to work in real time so that they can take the all of the aesthetic and amazing skills they've developed,
right.
say, on the visual effects side, and be able to transition to work into real time.
Right.
I think real time is just fundamentally going to redefine entertainment for the future.
Sure.
And whether it's how linear media is created, because
yep.
there's lots of virtual production techniques, or the nature of the actual experience that is being created, like we're talking about, where it's interactive in and of itself. And so, I think I should just take some Unreal classes and figure out how to do this, understand what it takes
sure.
to get it done. So that is a great suggestion. I would very much, anybody that's so inclined should absolutely at least take enough classes to understand what makes this possible.
Yeah.
And what the limitations are.
My company is very aware of that. And obviously, we make a very well-known and very powerful offline renderer, but we've committed at this point that we are going to need to do real-time. And so we've got our own real-time ray tracer that we've developed, because that's where we're going. And we're committed to ray tracing, number one, and real-time is where we're going. So I know that this is going to happen. And it's not just, I know what you're talking about in terms of narrative, but this is for all experiences.
Yep.
You know, because we have customers that are architects now that they just want to see the whole building and everything in real time, completely done and looking beautiful, and that's possible now.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's really something that I think is so important, that real time is going to be a big part of it. And you're right, THU. I've been to, like I said, this is my sixth THU, and it's every year is more and more and more real time, and starting to get into all the parts of it, because before real time was here, but it was mostly for people in the game industry.
Right.
But now we're talking about it for literally filmmaking, right?
So, well, and also, like, another interesting area is wellness or healthcare, for example.
Oh, yeah.
Or education.
Yeah.
Because I think that we could bring a lot of what, you know, the storytelling and the experiential design, bring it into these other, you know, adjacent sectors, if
right.
you will, you know, wellness and education, and we could really create transformative experiences.
Oh yeah, we should.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it's really, really interesting. Okay, so I want to go step out again, and like, let's not sort of put the real time and the VR aside.
Okay.
Let's go back to that studio where these guys want to make something, right? They want to make a movie studio. It doesn't
yep.
matter, but
yep.
let's say it's not VR.
Yep.
What are some of the pitfalls that young people can have when they try to start a business and they don't, like, how do they make a business plan? You
yeah.
said you did one.
Yeah. I think, I do think reaching out to available resources is a good thing. Because
okay.
for people that don't have the training or that's not their instinct, I think it is good to get that expertise from someone else. And, you know, I mean, I think it's everything from, like, the small business administration to, I mean, I think there's actually a variety of resources for how should you think about starting a business. But I do think that it's important to be realistic about the pace. Like, a lot of people come in, and I like don't want to squelch people's dreams because, you know, I believe in the dreamer in everyone.
No, but let's help them.
But I think that you've got to keep the dream alive over time. That's actually the key to success.
Okay.
And so it means being somewhat realistic. When I was talking about stepping stones before, you have to think about, okay, what do I need to survive?
Right.
And if I need, you know, X to survive, what are the things that I can do alongside pursuing my vision?
Okay.
It might mean, you know, I mean, there are plenty of people who work day jobs, if you will. And,
yeah.
you know, I mean, if you go to LA, as you know,
yep.
you know, you go to a coffee shop and you will see many aspiring writers and
actors.
Et cetera,
yep.
and actors, and they all have day jobs.
Yep.
But they still have this dream.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think being willing to sort of do what it takes in order to survive, literally,
yeah.
is fairly critical. Then, like I said, also seeking out resources just to help people think through the realities of the business and when it's likely to be real. And then, you know, I think there's a lot of people who, I mean, I talk a lot to people that I meet at conferences, et cetera. We're all facing, I mean, granted, I'm very, very fortunate to work inside of Lucasfilm and to have, to be affiliated with IP like Star Wars. There's just no question that
gives you an advantage.
It gives us a very big advantage. But still, we're all kind of looking out into the future wondering, when is this going to go from being, you know, something novel to something that is a real business opportunity?
Right.
And I actually can't tell you. It's not happening as fast as I thought it was going to.
Okay.
This is just my personal prediction.
Right.
I think it's going to take about 18 months now, between now and 18 months from
yeah.
now, to start to really see a pivot point. And so I, from a business planning perspective, I'm looking at what do we do for the next 18 months
mm-hmm.
that's going to bridge us, that's going to help us continue to push the state of the art, Because I think new opportunities will be available once we see that inflection point.
Okay.
I talk to and track a lot of market industry reports.
Right.
And one of the groups that I track is a group called Superdata out of New York.
Uh-huh.
They are now owned by Nielsen, but the Superdata portion of it is really, they specialize in AR/VR. And Stephanie Lamas, who has presented a number of conferences, I was talking to her, and she was saying there are they see sort of two potential inflection points. One is the introduction of a wearable AR, or mixed reality device that actually has broad consumer adoption. It could be Apple, we've talked about it for a while. It could be someone else. But their best guess was sometime, I think it was like very late 2020, maybe into 21. The other was the next generation of these tetherless headsets. So
sure.
Not V1.0, which is great,
right.
But it's really when V2.0 comes out
right.
That there's an inflection point. And either or both of those, I think will fundamentally change the nature and size of the business opportunity. So again, going back to like my whole 18-month thing, this is why I'm thinking 18 months is
that's not that much time, actually.
It's not that much time. No. But when you're kind of, you have a vision and you want to get it out there and you need to make a living along the way, it can feel like a really long time.
Sure.
So that's why I say I think, it's like leveraging all the avenues, the grant programs, the resources, but also being willing to have a day job. And hopefully that day job may in some way inform or give you, experience that will help you in the future.
Sure.
Yeah, it's such an interesting time. The other thing that she was saying is that they think that the growth curve of VR headsets is most like, because they usually track it along other technologies' evolution curves, and they think it's most like the color television. And what happened with the color television is it had this really, really slow ramp. It took 7 years before it actually had this very steep inflection point. And for 7 years...
Why was that?
Well, they said because people didn't think they necessarily needed it because they all have black and white televisions.
Right.
But the advantage that color television had is it was really easy to see what it did, right? Because they could have a color television in a store window and you could see what it's like to have a color picture.
Right.
The challenge with VR is until you put the headset on, you don't really understand why you have to have it. You know
right.
what I mean? And then you've got the additional element of, is there enough content to make it worthwhile? Mm-hmm. But that's I don't think we have 7 years now. I think we're into it.
Well, already started, right?
I'm going to guess we're in year five.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. Yeah, five.
And so all of those things, just say to me that there is light at the end of the tunnel. This is not stereo 3D.
Yep.
This is something new and powerful on its own, but it will take a little time.
Yeah, okay. That's interesting. Well, I think it's fascinating. I think that what you guys are doing is really interesting. I think you guys are really... You're solving a lot of problems for people that haven't gotten there yet, right? It's like the early days of filmmaking where they haven't figured out invisible editing,
yep.
they haven't done all this stuff, and you guys are figuring that out, and people will look to what you guys are doing as that next point, right? So at some point, people may look at some of the pieces you guys are doing and say, that's the Citizen Kane of VR. That's the thing that made it happen. So... it's really fascinating, and I think you guys are doing some wonderful work. I know a lot of people that are at XLab that are really great. And I think ILM is obviously the right place for all of this to start. So and you guys have some really good IP to work with, so it's really helping. It's really helping. It's funny, as I haven't seen, what was the first Star Wars one that you guys did?
Vader Immortal episode one, or no. Star Wars Secrets of the Empire.
I think it's Secrets of the Empire, right, at the Void. So one of my friends took his son to go see it, and he said it was really cool because you got to feel the lava and everything. And he says, but what was the best part for me is because he took his son, who was 10 and much shorter. He says, I saw my son as a little stormtrooper, and it was like something that just like the cutest thing in the world.
So. That's actually, I hear that a lot, because the stormtroopers literally do scale to your size.
Right. And he's like, he's a little stormtrooper.
He's a little guy.
It's so cool. So anyway, that was really, really cool. Well, thank you so much for doing this. It's been just about an hour, and we've had a great conversation. And you've revealed a lot of great information, and I think it's very exciting. I'm very excited to see your talk as well.
Thank you.
Are you excited to do it? Are you excited to be at THU?
I'm extremely excited to be at THU. I think that the thing I'm most nervous about is I want to be able to convey how passionate I am about this space. And you know, and do it in a way that is filled with hope and possibility for people, because I believe it's there.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.